I've always resisted being hypnotized, although I'm not morally opposed to it. I just, the times when it's been happening at a party or something like that, maybe I don't raise my hand fast enough to volunteer, or maybe my mind doesn't want my hand to go up fast enough to get sent up on stage. Whatever is the case, I've thought about it, kicked it around, think it'd be interesting, and I guess maybe part of me has always been reluctant to hand the keys to my consciousness over to somebody else and tell them to drive for a while. But if I were to do it, it would be with somebody like Rick Collingwood, who is the founder of Mind Motivations and the Australian Academy of Hypnosis. So he's, as I described last hour, I think fair to say that he's a student of consciousness, but he's a teacher of hypnosis. And somewhere in between those two things, we might have a better grip on being able to define what is being awake. How can we define our wakeful state? When do we know we're awake, and when do we know we're asleep? And what, or better phrased, when is it a dream? When does our mind slip into dream mode while we are awake? How can we tell exactly what is real? This is inspired in part by the ending of the TV series Lost, which left me lost, but left me asking these questions. And we'll get to some of those answers coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Hope you're driving carefully, Scratchy. And thank you, everybody, for driving carefully on this Memorial Day weekend. And we got a little bit left to go. Hopefully, we'll keep those fatality counts down. And one way we'll do that is by giving you a great show to stay up for if you're driving, listening to Coast. Rick Collingwood is a well-known international speaker, as well as being a trainer and somebody who swims easily in the various rivers of our mind. Good evening, Rick.
Hello, Ian. How are you?
Well, I'm great, except I'm a little confused when it comes to how we define what is a waking state. How many levels of consciousness do we have as human beings? How many do, and do we all have the same?
We all do have the same, but we spend in transient in and out of various levels at different times of the day and the night. Look, we basically have five. We have the beta state that we're in right now. Then we have the alpha state, which is the drifty, dreamy type of daydream state we can drift into. Then we have the true hypnotic state, which is the theta state, as the brain resonance begins to slow down. Below that one, we have the delta state, where the body repairs itself in deep dream sleep. And they've found a new one about 4 years ago called the gamma state, where they can basically measure very little consciousness happening in the body at all once one
Oh,
transients into that period for a few minutes.
that's very interesting.
It is.
Yeah, that they found a new level,
Yes.
that it had been there all along, but
Exactly.
we just discovered it. And so what does that mean when you say very little consciousness, that there's like, oh, like the brain activity just fires, slows down to.
Exactly. It's down to about half a cycle per second, whereas the beta cycle is up over 16. So really, the brain isn't doing much at all except keeping the body regulated and repairing cells. The ancient Egyptians, they said that sleep was death's little brother. That's what they called it. And they also said that if you're dreaming in color, then your consciousness has gone into what they called the semi-death state. So that's probably a good analogy to describe it. Obviously, you're not dead, but the body is just regulating along on its primal consciousness and repairing.
Relate this, if you would, to say, like the conscious and the subconscious. Where does the subconscious mind exist?
Okay, I think it exists in the connection between the brain and the heart. You'd be aware that they've now discovered we have a lot of neurons in our heart as well. They've also discovered crystal receptors in the brain. So it's very interesting. They have a device called a super quantum induction device that they can point at the human energy field. And they can see that our thought consciousness actually comes through our brain in a loop and loops around the outside of the top of our head and back in. So you know, this wonderment of whether we broadcast our thoughts or our energies or we're thinking with our brain has been very scientifically brought to the fore now. Of course, it's not made common knowledge, and unless you go looking for it, it's hard to find.
Well, explain that. So this is the thought that we could be projecting ourselves, or we could be projecting our innermost thoughts through a kind of energy field that exists very close to our outer skin.
Oh, we are constantly. That goes without a doubt. This is why we pick up hunches of people, why married couples or couples that are very close can basically read each other's thoughts, or they'll say the same thing at the same time. It has to be kept into perspective, though. It's not that we don't have, unless there's a few highly trained individuals, I think, that probably have the ability to read minds, like a couple of remote viewers that I've met that were very uncanny. But really, they've found all the senses, the receptors now that enable this thought transference, but it works along the lines of the same energy that will make 1,000 starlings all twist in the air at the same time and not crash into each other and what have you.
Right.
It's not a direct conscious thing for most people, but you can't be conscious of something until you become consciously aware of it anyway.
Yeah, no, and I love that. So, that's also a very fascinating conversation, is how do all the starlings know to go left, then right, then left again, and not slam into each other? How does that happen so effortlessly? And it isn't that they have, I mean, it looks like mass mind, but is it just that? Could it be something else? And in this case, if I'm getting the comparison, when you're standing next to somebody, if you are intuitive, if one is in tune with one's own receptors, you're suggesting that they would be able to pick up the thoughts, the feelings of somebody else, even passively, not judging by any hand motions or anything else, just because that information is being broadcast from the body at some frequency.
Exactly. And the more emotion that the person in the environment that's doing the broadcasting has attached to something, the more powerful it becomes. Emotion seems to be the driving force to enhance the field. So whether it be an emotion of anger or love or confusion, you know yourself, you can sense when you're 20 feet away from somebody, usually, whether they're angry or happy or indifferent. But we do have, as I said, the receptors for these. After the invention of the electron microscope, the scientists decided that if we have receptors in the body for sight, sound, touch, taste, and what have you, if anything electromagnetic exists, there must be receptors for it. So they went looking for these receptors, and they defined them as cells or groups of cells that could recognize and interpret electromagnetic stimuli. And they found we've got millions of them, each person. So there is no great mystery to the so-called intuition or being psychic. It's a natural ability that the animals still tend to use with monotonous regularity. But the human beings, of course, we all think we're a lot cleverer than what we really are. So
yeah, but I think that I think that requires another definition, though, too, I would imagine, because there's some people that just... I don't think would have the same kind of receptors. There's some people that, like, you have some people that are born with longer fingers, or people who are born with the gene that is going to have all their hair fall out. There's some people who just don't have that those receptors turned on.
Oh, look, I 100% agree with you. Most people don't, I would say. If you're not aware that you've got them, for a start, it just comes through usually as hunches or feelings or things we disregard. You know, we're all guilty of many times saying, I knew I should have done this or I knew I should have done that. But these things work, we'll use the word intuition, so they work intuitively. And none of it, we're not often encouraged to use or develop our intuition. So many of these receptors lie dormant. I should imagine they're like the mind and like muscles. If they're not used very often, they're not going to be very powerful.
So, again, we're talking here with Rick Collingwood, who is both a student of consciousness and a teacher of hypnosis. I'm so fascinated by what you said earlier, though, that I want to go back to when you were breaking down the levels of consciousness.
Yeah.
And you said that in our alpha state, That's when we can be daydreaming. I think I'm in my alpha state more than the average person. And I don't know why I believe that, but I really do think that's true. And so are we awake in our alpha state?
We are awake, but we're not fully attentive and alert like we are in a beta state. So the alpha state we drift into automatically once we begin to relax. You know, when you sit in front of a television, usually within about 35 to 40 seconds, you go straight into alpha and then get absorbed into what's on the TV, especially if you like the program. But you'll find when you get near a television, for example, even if the worst program in your mind is on, you'll still keep flicking your eyes to it, you know, even if the volume is turned down. So televisions automatically put us into alpha, and so does a lot of music if it's played at the right beat and tone as well.
Okay, but I mean, I think that what I experience is kind of a blend of reality and dream material when I'm in an alpha state, and so I'm daydreaming, but I'm also processing these things that I'm hearing, and it feels, and that's what I was trying to get a sense for. It doesn't feel like I'm awake. It feels like I'm having a dream within wakefulness.
Yes.
Right. And so what can we learn from that? What's the benefit of that? And how can we use that to our advantage?
The benefit of that is it's relaxing for the mind, unless we're being fearful or negative about it and locked in a fearful emotional state in alpha at the same time. But the main benefits of it are that it keeps us away from having to be fully focused and attentive on everything all the time. A classic example is when you drive your car. Once you know how to drive and that pattern has been formed in your subconscious mind, you know, many times we drive home and don't remember very much of the drive at all because the
right
pattern to get there is achieved. So the alpha state basically enables us to cruise along on autopilot. But having said that, it will then begin to access usually the patterns that have been pre-learned and programmed into the subconscious mind. So really to use it to your advantage, you have to be very, very careful about what you think and very repetitive on positive thinking to yourself, because the two minds, for example, the mind doesn't learn to think. What happens is that through repetition or an instant emotional reaction, we stamp a pattern into our subconscious mind, which is very much like the hard drive of a computer. Once it's there, it will give an automatic reaction until it's shifted or changed or altered through another repetition.
So when you are hypnotizing somebody, what state do you reach them in, and then in what state do you leave them in?
Okay, when you hypnotize somebody, the hypnosis I do will take them down into the theta state, which is very deep hypnosis. Before I go further with that, there's many things out there now that are called hypnosis which aren't true hypnosis as such as NLP and private subconscious healing. They induce alpha states. I use traditional hypnosis and mesmerism, which will induce a theta state. When you immerse somebody from that, they feel on quite a high for a while, and they usually remain in the alpha state for about 8 to 10 hours.
Okay, but so you reach them originally in the state above alpha state, and you leave them. What's that?
In the beta state,
and you leave them in the theta state when you're done with them, right?
No, they can't. They go down into the theta state in hypnosis, and then when they're finished, they will come back up usually into an alpha state. Yeah. But having said that, many people are very, very nervous about hypnosis. So often, before you've hypnotized them, they've automatically slipped into an alpha state anyway in a protection mode. So there's more fear or concern there than clear thinking.
So when somebody is experiencing a post-hypnotic suggestion,
yeah,
in what state are they? Are they awake or are they asleep?
They are in an awake state. The post-hypnotic suggestion, depending on what it was, as soon as it appears in the environment, they will drop state immediately into a theta state and carry out the suggestion.
Okay, so in a way, they're both.
Exactly. They look at switches in a tenth of a second. It's extraordinary to experience and to see.
Well, and that's so we, it is possible for us to be awake and asleep at the same time.
Oh, definitely. Look, when we drift into a really, really deep daydream, for all intents and purposes, we've gone to sleep. We just have an awareness of our surroundings that we don't have when we're in the deep sleep state.
Right. And so where did drugs come into this? I mean, Ambien and a lot of other drugs that make that put people to sleep also seemingly open up the door for them to do many things as though they are awake, like get in a car, drive 100 miles, go to a strip joint. I mean, do things that people theoretically would never do while they're awake. They are known to do as a side effect sometimes of some of these sleeping pills, right?
Yes. Look, what they're doing is they're interrupting the pre-learned patterns down in the subconscious, but they're also significantly retarding the beta state as well.
Okay, so when somebody is experiencing some sort of drug-induced, like a sleep state...
hypnagogic, yeah.
What do you call that, I'm sorry?
A hypnagogic drug-induced state.
I love that. So they are asleep, but there's a part of them that is awoken to push some levers and hit some buttons and just sort of almost sort of drunk drive the body,
yes,
even though the body's asleep.
That's correct. Look, the body, we have 70 to 90 trillion cells in our body that are all completely regulated by the subconscious mind through the nervous systems. So, for example, I suppose a classic way to describe that would be someone that's in a coma for 5 or 6 years. And they're measuring very low brain state, but the body is still completely functional and all of the organs are doing their thing. And some people come out of these comas and some don't. So the body can remain quite functional without an awareness or a full awareness state of mind being operative at the same time. Well, it does it when we're in a deep sleep too.
Have you been hypnotized yourself?
Oh, yes, most definitely.
Okay, do you enjoy being hypnotized?
I do, because it's a wonderful, wonderful detached state where a lot of the external pressures and worries of the day just don't really have a precedence. And good hypnosis, you will actually lose total awareness of the body. So you feel like you're a mind floating, if you will.
Is it true that... when somebody is hypnotized, you cannot make them do something that they wouldn't be inclined to do otherwise?
Only if you're not a good hypnotist. That's my best answer to that. Look, this we can't make people do anything against their will is complete nonsense. About 25% of people, you can have them do what you will. But for example, if a person capable of immediate deep trance is called a somnambulist. Now, if I had a somnambulist up on top of a roof and I put them in hypnosis and I said in a moment you're going to go and jump off that roof, they probably wouldn't do it because there's a hidden observer there that would protect them. But if I said to them that they were a gardener and they loved roses and they were in the rose garden and just through that gate are the most beautiful roses that there are, so they're going to take a step up and then they're going to walk into the rose garden, they would probably walk off the roof. They wouldn't intentionally jump off if the subconscious was aware there was a danger, but it's very easy to convince the subconscious that there isn't.
I like that idea. Not that I want people to do it, but I like that it's sort of cinematic in a way, that it's all about the way in which you're framing their dream.
Totally. For it is.
Right.
Totally.
And that you could frame it in such a way that there would be there would be self-protective mechanisms that would kick in, or you could essentially throw the guard dogs of the mind some meat that has some sleeping pills in it, and you could get the guard dogs to lay down. They put them right, and then you could just proceed in to the mind. Well, very good. This is where we're just getting started with Rick Collingwood, the founder of Mind Motivations and the Australian Academy of hypnosis. Then I want to talk about the difference between our conscious state just before we die. And I also want to talk about the number of thoughts that we can have at any one given time. If anybody will know, it's Rick Collingwood next on Coast to Coast. We're talking with Rick Collingwood about the nature of consciousness and the divisions. What we're learning here are very dotted line divisions between our waking states and our sleeping states, and we can go back and forth between them fairly effortlessly. We can attempt to manage them ourselves, even. They can happen on their own. But we can start in a fairly awake state, like a beta state, and we can slip into an alpha state without even realizing it. We can manifest some aspects of sleeping even while we're awake and vice versa. While we're sleeping, we can actually not just feel like we're awake. Part of our brain can be awake while the other part isn't. But what about the divisions between the alive state and the dead state? Rick Collingwood mentioned earlier that the Egyptians had a term for that, right? That sleep was death's little brother. Well, what happens when Big Brother steps in? What are the phases of consciousness into death? And what can we experience at the cusp of death that we can't even imagine in our current either waking or dreaming states? We'll talk about that. What research is being done on what happens to the brain leading up to death next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. Rick Collingwood, I know you've worked with the patients that have had cancer, and you worked with their bodies in terms of how they were going to reject these cancer cells and to try to train their minds to put up another level of defense against the cancer. But have you ever worked with people who were in a near-death state?
I'll say this to you, Ian. I've done a tremendous amount of work with cancer and using hypnosis for improvement in the quality of life. Unfortunately, most people will turn to hypnosis because it's so misunderstood, or the type of hypnosis I use at the last moment. But in the last 18 months, I've been with 19 people as they passed that have been in serious stage 4 cancer in Europe, in Australia, and in the UK. Not one of them has passed with fear, that I can say. And to bring a bit of unexplained science into it, I've seen some very strange things happen in rooms with doctors beside me as people have passed. So what it has given me a 100% confidence, without a doubt, that when we do finish here, it's by no means over.
Well, I love that. So let's pick at that a little bit, if you don't mind. You say you've been in places where people were passing. What happens? Have you hypnotized them while they're going through these final stages?
I give all the cancer patients I've worked with one-on-one a post-hypnotic suggestion that if they're feeling pain or they're afraid or whatever situation may arise in their mind, that they'll simply close their right hand and everything will calm for them. And it has a phenomenal effect on their quality of life. I would never make the statement that hypnosis cures cancer, because I don't believe anything does, but it certainly allows these people to pass with tremendous peace.
I love that idea. So what is it that's helping to bridge that? Just a post-hypnotic suggestion that says you're in a field full of puppies and you're being licked by puppies.
Just a direct suggestion that if they feel fearful, they will simply close their hand and that fear will subside like a wave retracts back from a beach once it's broken. If they're feeling pain, like you'll see a stage hypnotist will put someone into trance and tell them if they sit down, it will feel as though they're sitting on a hot coal, for example. You can take the exact same technique and say to somebody who's in agony with cancer that they can't feel that pain anymore. And if it does come back, they'll simply close their hand and it will subside away again. And it's phenomenally effective. So it enables a person to relax as they're going through their illness. And unfortunately, if it's at too late a stage, all we can do is let them pass in a much more comfortable way.
So then is there a different stage that kicks in between? We mentioned all the different states of waking and sleeping. Is there a different stage that happens somewhere between the gamma state and death?
I think that there is, and I really think that the gamma state is the passing over state or the death state, to be honest. That's my opinion. I don't have any scientific evidence of that, but common sense would say that to me. I've never seen a person I've worked with pass with fear, and I've had so many of their relatives and loved ones say to me afterwards, you know, ever since you've worked with this person, they've just been completely different, and the fear of wanting to go or the fear of going has subsided away. So I did some cancer trials in Perth with doctors and oncologists and 9 terminal cancer patients in 2005. And they were all monitored on the correct forms and what have you. And the results were astounding. That research is actually on my website, mindmotivations.com. And a lot of this is we get consciously locked into fear, and it will just circle around and around and around, and it just begins to enhance the erosion. For example, doctors can say to somebody, you've got terminal cancer, and I think you've got 3 months to live, and you can bet pretty close to that time that's when they'll pass. So,
yeah, just the power of suggestion enough that the person isn't equipped to be able to stand up against something that potent as as a calendar in their mind.
And it has this effect. For example, if I said to somebody, and don't do this, think about the most fear, close your eyes and think about the most fearful situation you've ever been in your life, and you start thinking about that, your body will begin to react very, very quickly to it. The sweating and the nervous feeling in the stomach and the heart rate goes up. So, you know, some of these doomsday prophecies that some doctors will give out, I don't think they're very helpful, but of course they're legally obligated to do that and to work it with their exact scientific research.
We're talking with Rick Collingwood, who is a professional hypnotist as well as a teacher of hypnosis and somebody who's been studying the various levels of consciousness and sleep states for years. Okay, so I do some work volunteering for the church, I often end up in a pastoral role. And I've had a couple of times over the last few years where I've been with somebody who had been in a who were recovering from something. I mean, that might have been a head injury. It might have been an overall body trauma. It might have been some sort of a mental trauma. But sometimes you see where people, they always say, doctors say, I'm sure you would agree, that there's a state of consciousness where the body has a chance to repair itself. What state did you say was the repairing state?
That's down in the delta state.
So, but there are sometimes when I think when they get into a delta state, great at night, but in the daytime, some people get into these mental patterns, these just circular patterns where they can't seem to relax, whether it's because they're worrying about not healing fast enough, because they're impatient about being in the hospital, because they don't like the atmosphere of nurses and doctors coming in and disturbing them every 10 minutes, that they end up getting this sort of like, almost like a crazed look in their eye, almost where their every glance is furtive left and right. Like it just, they feel trapped. It's hard to not feel sorry for them. Would hypnosis work at a time like that to slow down their thought processes or to give them suggestions so that would allow them to be in a state in consciousness that more closely replicates the repairing state of the delta state?
Oh, most definitely. Look, when we began our cancer trials, I developed and patented a special frequency of the theta rhythm at F sharp. And I have a big range of self-help CDs available on my website. And we use one called Mind Body Healing that I use with all my cancer treatments. And it's quite extraordinary, the shift that it makes very, very quickly. There's hundreds of testimonials on the website, but if I can just say this, there's also a free complete hypnosis session download available there that your listeners can go and download with this frequency in it and experience this state for themselves. It doesn't cost them anything, and they're welcome to do that.
And so that might be the kind of thing, if you're not available, we could try it with a CD, but if it needed a person present, there are reputable hypnotherapists that would be able to try to transform somebody's agitated waking state into a more comfortable delta state?
Oh, significantly. I would just suggest to ensure that the person or the hypnotherapist being used has got some good credentials and belongs to a major hypnosis association, and okay. never let them talk you out of your medical treatments.
Right. Very interesting. Thank you. All right. So now you said that when you were working with these patients in stage four cancer, you were with them during their end of life stages. You saw some things along with the doctors. You experienced some things. What did you hint at there a few minutes ago?
Well, look, I'll go out on a bit of an esoteric limb here. I was with one lady in a clinic in Switzerland. Now, the Swiss medical doctors, I also do mesmerism. Now, when people are filled up with morphine and they're near the end, the heart rate will bounce all over the place and the blood pressure will go up and down. And I can stand there, put my hand into their energy field while they're hooked up to these machines, and ask a doctor for a heart rate. And they might say, for example, 85. And within a minute or so, it will go to 85 and it will stabilize there for maybe an hour. Now, when I do that in the UK, the doctors are convinced that the machine is rigged or that I've got some electronic device. When I do it in Switzerland, the doctors there will go, "Oh, you are like the healers from the Alps. We don't know how this works, but keep doing it." So there's vast differences. But in this particular clinic in Nyon in Switzerland, as this lady passed, or about an hour before she did, two lights turned up in the room. Now, there was three medical doctors in there that saw them with me, and they were just stunned. And one was blue and one was yellow. And they were hovering around in this room, and this woman's eyes were just locked onto them.
Wow.
And they were visible for all to see. And one of these doctors freaked a bit, and he said, "What have you done? What have I done? What have you done?" And I said, "All I can say is that they're energies that are vibrating at a higher frequency than we are." And that's all you can say with this. I call it unexplained science. When you look at the quantum realm in relation to consciousness and matter, it's really quite self-evident. There's a finite amount of atoms in the universe. And atoms, when you zoom up to one, you go straight out the other side of it. They're not actually solid. So I'm convinced that there is this interconnectedness between all things. Then Newton came along with his measurable physics. But when you read Newton's work, Newton said there is something else that is an energy that binds all things together, but I don't have the instruments to measure it, so I'm not going to postulate any further on it. So he worked with exact science, being a scientist, and wouldn't take it any further. And the quantum physicists of the modern era have gone way into this and discovered some amazing stuff, and unfortunately it doesn't all get poured out onto the public because it would collapse a lot of perceptions, you know.
Well, I think there'd be a lot of people that would be open to the collapsing of perceptions if it were more than just anecdotal testimony. So taking nothing away from your story, I think that there is, like, that's the kind of thing that when it gets captured in a way that can be, yeah, I know this sounds really boring, but peer reviewed, and where somebody can really dissect it and really unpack it, and it gets outside of the realm of the of 100 years of special effects photography and spirit photography and all that other stuff, and it can actually make it something real to even the most skeptical. Then I think it wouldn't be collapsing perceptions; it would be expanding them.
And I think perceptions are expanding. Look at the cognitive science laboratory at the Stanford Research Institute. There's a lot of amazing information you can read on there. A lot of this information you have to go hunting for. It's not available in the standard scientific or educational texts. But when one goes looking and looks for long enough and hard enough, it's certainly there. I spent my first few years, for example, as a hypnotist or a therapist, doing what's called Ericksonian hypnosis, which is quite effective, but it doesn't usually induce a deep trance state. And I had those few years of thinking, no, we can't make anyone do anything against their will and what have you, but I was broad-minded or inquisitive enough to go researching and hunting further and quickly realized that I'd been in a fog myself. So my last 10 years professionally has been to bring the deep trance state and mesmerism back into hypnosis to make it far more effective. It got very distorted.
Well, I know who Otto Mesmer was, but I don't think I understand the difference between mesmerism and hypnotism.
Mesmer, in a mesmeric session, there was never any speaking done. He used energetic transference that he called mesmerism, and he postulated that there was an ethereal fluid that came down from the heavens and he could control it. It could probably be best described as a form of Reiki, but a very, very powerful form of Reiki healing energy. When you research Mesmer and research him and research him and sift all the junk away, right, he was very, very effective at what he did, but there was no words used with the trance states that he induced.
So how did he bring it about then? Just through a look? Just through light? Just through
mind transference or energetic transference and a look.
Well, what's the medium for that? What's the actual, I mean, mind transference by what, holding somebody's hand? I mean,
by looking at them.
Just looking at them.
Yeah, look, the eyes, we don't see with our eyes. They're simply a lens to the brain. Our right eye is attached to our left brain, and our left eye is attached to our right brain, and the eyes are light receptors. Light carries information, so therefore, a well-trained hypnotist that can stare directly into somebody's eyes for 10 minutes without blinking will set up this loop, if you will, from left eye to right eye. So it's like a figure eight. And then whatever the hypnotist or the therapist holds as a strong intention will be picked up as a thought by the other person or the subject. And because they're not aware that there's more than just individual free thinking, they begin to think their thought as their own. And our thoughts create our feelings. So it's literally a way of transferring information and putting someone down into a deep, deep trance. And that heralds right back to the Egyptian times of the earliest hypnosis, which was fascination. And it was all done with looks. And what Mesmer did was he studied Richard Mead, who was an astronomer, not an astrologer. And he looked at the effects that the planets might have on our energy systems. And then he also studied Paracelsus, and Paracelsus was a known psychic of his time, if you will, and an energetics researcher. And when you look at who Paracelsus studied, he studied the ancient Egyptians and their methods. And a lot of this information got distorted and distilled over time and
right,
became what we have now.
For better or for worse, it's what we have now. And so good to go back to the original sources for a lot of this, too, and to reconsider it. Well, I want to go back to what you were talking before about the appearance of the lights and being with doctors. So they observed, too, during these final stages of somebody's life. What do you think happens to the soul when the body gives it up?
Personally, I think that we go back and join the universal energy, if you will, and maintain a speck of individual consciousness within it, because we don't have that much individual consciousness. For example, a person who's a genius with a level of Einstein's IQ, you're capable consciously of thinking of seven things at once. Most people about five. The subconscious, for example, it has about 4 quadrillion things a second to do just to keep the body running. So imagine what else it is linked, and I believe it's directly linked into the universal energy. And hence, we are all linked together. There's only 4 components of matter, and there's consciousness as well. We look around ourselves. Every single thing that you can see in the world, not of nature, began as a thought. The consciousness came from somewhere. And I believe we go back and rejoin that consciousness.
And so our consciousness then, well, here, let me finish the rest of that thought coming up on what happens with our consciousness. And then what about the stories that people tell about how their life passed before their eyes before they died? I'm going to ask Rick Collingwood about that. He's a hypnotist. He's somebody who's a teacher of hypnosis. And we're talking about the qualities of consciousness next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.